Hello and welcome to the Lone Star Capital podcast, a Salt Lake City best ever edition with some best in class sponsors as well. Obviously, everyone knows these two gentlemen here, but I'll give the introduction. Zach and Bikram of Rise 48, and of course, Rob Beardsley, co-founder and principal of the firm, myself, Craig McGrother, the director of business development. Gentlemen, how's the conference been so far?
It's been good. It's been good, guys. Thank you for having us. We have a lot of respect for you guys. So excited to be on your show here. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
For sure. Definitely looking forward to it. It's been a great couple days at Best Ever. We'd be curious to know what your guys' strategy is when coming to a conference like this.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, Rob. So we've done a lot of conferences. And honestly, last year, we probably spent more money on sponsoring conferences than like any other year. And like 90% of them are totally worthless. Like, we didn't get any investors. Yeah. It's like all vendors. And so like Bikram talks like, this year, we're literally sponsoring this conference. I think this is the only one we've signed up for because we get a lot of LPs and there's fund managers. Okay. So like, we're always trying to like get more bandwidth to raise more equity. And so, you know, I told all of our team, I said, hey, LPs are great, but try to find fund managers because it's a compliant way for us to raise more money. If I can get a $500,000 check instead of a 50K check, it's just more effective for us. So that's honestly our strategy, is just trying to attract people who want to partner with operators. And I know it's funny because we work with a lot of the same fund managers, right? And they say, always say good things about you guys. Yeah, so that's kind of our strategy. I mean, Bick, I don't want to take it all here. You talk about your experience so far.
Yeah.
At the conference.
Yeah, no, it's been pretty good. I'm, you know, at the booth pretty much all day and just kind of talking to LPs, talking to fund managers. And it's interesting because we end up getting a lot of investors coming up to us, asking us questions, which is good because then we have that face-to-face contact and they just get more confident, you know, as they meet the people in real life. So I met a couple of good investors that we've had. One investor has invested in every single Dallas deal that we've, you know, done this year. And this is the first time I met him in face-to-face. So he's excited for, you know, our future deals. But yeah, it's been good so far.
Yeah, last year we had a sponsor as well. We had a booth. And then this year we were statues. We literally had the table outside of like the coffee market area. Yeah. Didn't move. We had, you know, all of our meetings kind of pre-set up before. A couple people floated in between. But Best Ever is a really interesting mix from a conference perspective. There's not many where you actually have some institutional equity partners, whether it be like Flagship or PPR being here. I'm sure there's a couple others.
Yeah.
But legitimate LPs looking to find sponsors and then fund managers as well. So it's like one of the only melting pots of conferences where you get the cross section of all parties here, which is super cool and unique in many respects. So I love that. And to your point, There was people that like we had met before, spoke on the phone. We were at LFI event last night with TribeVest hosting that.
Yeah.
And like people came up to us like, oh, that's you guys. Like, I've invested you guys, or I know you guys.
I know,
and it's
right?
Like, I know your face on Zoom.
Or you feel like you know them because you've seen them on Zoom. It's like, we haven't actually met in person. I just realized that right now. Yeah.
So I guess I have a camera optics issue because everyone thinks I'm a midget. Because I guess literally the zoom is kind of coming down on this.
That's
and
funny.
I'm an I6'3.
You're a tall dude. Yeah, it's all the angles, man. We just got to get your angles.
You know, but I kind of want to troll and make it like worse and like make the problem like more enhanced and like go from a higher angle below so I look really small. So.
There you go. Yeah. Be a small person.
Yeah
there you go. Target that demographic. Yeah. Everybody has an investor avatar. That's right. Yeah,
exactly. I want to be really just approachable, right?
Yeah.
So, and the suit sometimes, you know, can be a little standoffish. So
that is, yeah.
But we'd love to get into kind of the story of how you both met, you know, and dive in there.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Bikram kind of talk about his background, but like in January of 2018, I quit my job and lived off of savings to figure out how to get into this. I just started going to like meetups, conferences, listen to podcasts and try to grind it out. So I met Bikram at a conference in Dallas. And I actually had tied up a deal and we brought Bikram in like midway through. He kind of just bailed us out by bringing in like 150K of his own money. And we did like a tenant in common structure. So we didn't raise any LP money. We just did it ourselves. And then I was like, wow, this guy's really smart. Like, he's like the missing piece. And the rest is kind of history. So, I mean, you kind of talk about your background, Bikram. I got into it.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, my career has been in finance the entire time. I worked as a external auditor with PwC, Grant Thornton, went to do management consulting after, and I had a couple of clients that were, you know, REITs or auction.com, for instance, was one of my big clients. So I ended up getting really interested in doing real estate. And, you know, around the time that Zach had their deal tied up, I ended up, my wife and I were kind of looking into getting into real estate. It was just kind of like the right moment, right time. Met up with them. And then, you know, it was a perfect mix because like Zach's the outgoing guy who's going to go tie up the deals, find the equity, find the deals and build those relationships. And I'm the numbers guy. I don't like being in front of a camera. I don't like talking to people. I'm more of a, just give me a spreadsheet. I'll figure it out. You go do your thing.
That's really interesting. And I think that's a common theme with founders and people that come together. You want to have complementary skill sets, obviously, not redundancies. And if you have people who have, let's say, egos and both of them want to be in the spotlight, that can just create so much tension that will never be resolved. One thing I'd like to learn more about is Kent and I, as the founders of Lone Star, there's so much, and of course this is true for anybody starting a company, you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what responsibilities you're going to have in the future. When you start out, all you really are focusing on is acquisitions because you don't have any assets to manage.
Right.
But then as you acquire deals, asset management becomes a bigger and bigger function.
Yeah.
And there's all these other functions like accounting and reporting and things that you didn't really think about when you first started. And I for sure didn't think about doing a podcast or writing books as part of a real estate company. Right.
Yep.
So I'd be curious to know how you guys originally viewed your divide and conquer and then how that has evolved.
Yeah. Great question, Rob. And so, I mean, before I met Bikron, I had like quote unquote, like dated like six or seven different business partners. Right. I mean, you guys are probably experienced where you meet somebody, like you're trying to get into it. Like, hey, you want to do deals? You want to be in this market? What's your background? What do you want to focus on? And then what I found is some people didn't want to work as hard as me. And I'm like, okay, you're not going to be the one. Some people were experienced. They had like thousands of units, but then they didn't want to do anything. So they're just kind of using me and not giving me any compensation. And then there was one guy where we had like nightly calls for 2 months. Great guy, hard worker, ton of respect for him. But then I realized he has the exact same skill set as me, right? So to your point, Rob, I was like, I need a true finance guy. It's not my strength. I freaking hate sitting in front of an Excel spreadsheet. Drives me crazy. And I'm not good at it, right? So I was like, I need a finance guy. And so I was literally seeking Bikron's skill set out. Like it was very intentional. And I had found another lady that we were partnering with the first few deals. And when we realized Bikron was just more superior, I just told her. It was tough. I was like, hey, I'm not going to work with you anymore. Like Bikron's taking that role. And we did all the future deals with Bikron. And so, you know, the complementary skill set is key. But like to your point, you don't know what you don't know. Like when we started out, we never planned on starting a property management company. I thought you could just buy deals, throw a third party management company, and I'd sit back and get the cash flow and be on a beach, financial freedom, like everybody says. That's
The picture of the Mai Tai.
Exactly. Yeah, the Mai Tai.
Passive investing.
Yeah, I'm making money while I sleep, blah, 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 right? But we quickly realized it was literally our first deal. We had a third party property management company. They were doing the construction management. They were not staying on schedule, on budget. And we're like, we got to take control of this. This is BS. Like I was out at the property, like chewing out vendors. I was like, this is not what I signed up for. And so we had to first build out construction management before anything. We hired a construction manager to like source, bid out and manage vendors. And then it was like, and I'm going to pass it to Bikron Sherwood because he'll talk about all the back office stuff. Because Bikron really deserves all the credit for all the accounting, operations, investor reporting, all that stuff. And distributions, all that. But, you know, we realized, okay, I was getting bogged down with like transactional stuff, like doing all the lender docs, all the lenders council communication for acquisition. So it was Bikron, Robert, and I, and we were doing every little minutia detail when we started. So we learned every little detail of the company, from investor relations to marketing, asset management, acquisitions, accounting. So then when we started to generate revenue, we could reinvest that money in the company and build out departments. And we would basically recruit, hire and train people to do what we already were doing because we knew how to do it and we were learning as we go, right? But like we kind of just had to keep adapting as we go. And I'll pass it to you, Bikron, because you built out a financial planning analysis department, accounting, and you built out investor relations. So,
yeah. I mean, from the beginning, you know, when we first started, we had our own individual companies. Like Zach had ZH Multifamily, I had Bride Investors and stuff. But my vision was always like, I don't want to do this co-sponsor thing where I, you know, do one deal with Zach, tomorrow I do another deal with somebody else. I just wanted to kind of settle down, so to speak. So when we started working with Zach, or when I started working with Zach, you know, I was like, okay, this is where I want to be. I want to do these deals. He's a great guy for, you know, he's complementing my skill sets. When I don't have to talk to people on my end, I can just do my spreadsheets. At the time, I'd read a book called The E-Myth. I don't know if you guys
have
read it. Yeah. Yeah. So in there, it kind of talks about, you don't just jump into a company and just, like Zach mentioned, you just go in and start like building everything out, everything goes well, right? One of the things that it talked about was like building out like an org chart of a company you envision one day it's going to be. And then you put names for people that are currently the founders. So I put my name behind, you know, accounting, reporting, distributions, all the finance side. I put Zach on the acquisitions front, you know, Robert on the construction side. And as we started to generate revenue, made a conscious decision to kind of hire out the staff that was taking up our time that was not generating revenue. So on my end, I was doing a lot of asset management. Deals had closed, they're doing well, we're sending out distributions, but we have pref in peace. So we're not generating revenue at that point when the deal is going through its business cycle. So I needed someone to basically manage the properties so that we could focus on buying additional deals, kind of building up our assets under management. So we hired out our asset manager, then we hired out, a transactions manager under Zach is taking all these docs. It was taking a lot of time. It was taking away his time from talking to brokers and generating new leads. So slowly over time, we started building out those departments and then became, then it was accounting, then it was investor reporting. So we built out the system. We built out the processes for how to do monthly distributions, how to do monthly investor reporting. Where did we pull the reports from, put together all the SOPs, and then we put an individual in place who we thought was going to be one day going to lead that department. That's the person we hired to take over and then go ahead and, mold it for them so that they can take over that specific department and take it to the next level. So we slowly kind of built that out. Obviously, at the beginning, everything was going through Zach and I. We wanted to make sure every communication to external parties was crisp and clean. There weren't any negligible errors. So we went in, reviewed everything, but slowly kind of handed off the reins to people as we thought, okay, well, we don't have to be on every lender call every single week. I don't have to worry about, them getting the 1,000 documents that they need. They can go ahead and our transactions manager can do that. We don't have to worry about that. So we slowly handed off the reins and kind of focused more on the revenue generating activities as opposed to the back office products.
That's awesome. So you mentioned the first deal you guys did was in Dallas. He kind of bailed you out, so to speak, at that point, as you mentioned. Good call on that one. A little equity created a lot of equity and, many exits.
That's
so
right.
A couple billion dollars later in transactions and volume, here you are now. So congratulations on that there. But you said the first deal was in Dallas. So you mentioned before we got on the show that, of course, and it's well known that you're from Phoenix.
Yeah.
So you're not from Phoenix, though, if I'm not mistaken. So how did you guys both identify as Phoenix as the core and target market that you wanted to be landing? Because everyone, I think if you think of, multifamily real estate syndication, I think the first thing people think about is, frankly, Rise 48. And obviously 48, Arizona, of course.
Yeah, you know what that is about, Craig. Yeah,
yes.
You know the 48, right?
And by the way, I have to say, on the 51 Highway not too long ago, I saw you donated that. So good on you for that.
Oh, yeah, signed it,
yeah.
Thank you, Craig.
Very cool.
Yeah, no, good question, man. So, so the first deal was in Phoenix. And, we were honestly very fortunate that, Phoenix was, one of the most attractive markets when we started. And that was just coincidence, right? I didn't know anything. When I quit the job, I wasn't planning to do multifamily. I was, looking at flipping houses. I was looking at all types of asset classes. I cold called 90 mobile home park owners to try to do a sell or carry before I learned about multifamily and decided to do syndication. So right in 2018, I personally spent 14 months full time with no job trying to get the first deal. And it took 14 months to close the first deal. And that was tough because you're just burning through cash. I felt like a failure, honestly. I lost all my confidence. I was like, what the hell am I doing? Every day I wake up and there's nothing to move the needle. But we were fortunate that we were in a really strong market at the time. And everything I heard about was you have to have boots on the ground. You should be in your market. So I just happened to grow up and live in Phoenix, right? Bikron lived in Orange County, Southern California, and he was trying to get into Phoenix. Okay. And so we met at a conference in Dallas, and that's when we started to talk. And so, and then I said, hey, I got a Phoenix deal. And so he was intrigued, drove out. And a credit to Bikron, I have a lot of respect for him because he said, Bikron is naturally introverted. He doesn't want to be talking to brokers. This guy was driving out here on a Thursday night to spend all day Friday. He had a full-time job touring deals with brokers. He's a CPA accounting type of personality, and it's intimidating to go tour these 100 plus unit deals with brokers, but he was doing it on his own, trying to find deals. And so for us, it was just that I was local, Robert was local with the construction background. It was a good market. And our whole thing is we were so scared, and we still are today, of failing. It's such a big burden to take investor money, and we don't take it lightly, right? And a big part of us continuing to reinvest in infrastructure is because we understand that there's perceptions of us that we grew too fast. There's a lot of haters out there say you guys grew too fast, you're just transactions, you're just buying deals to buy deals. Well, if people saw the inside, they wouldn't think that, because we are basically just building out stronger and stronger infrastructure to get results, and we want to scale responsibly. So part of staying in Phoenix initially is let's go deep in this one market, make sure we can master the market. And we were lucky that the market was strong, right? But then and we can kind of go into this later, but by the end of 2022, we had bought 40 deals in Phoenix. And a lot of these investors had invested 10 deals. And they're like, hey, we like the reporting, we like you guys, but I don't want to keep investing in the same market. I want diversification. We were waiting until we felt confident that we had supply chain, operational infrastructure, reporting, all that stuff kind of systematized so that when we did add a new market, we could do it responsibly. And so that's kind of the reason why we did that.
To your point, I don't think a lot of people are aware of the infrastructure that you guys have built, right? Because they see the headlines, they say, oh, Rise 48's buying a deal, another deal, another deal. And that's, and they assume, or they're haters, like you said.
Yeah.
But I mean, I follow you guys and I've, you know, checked out your website and stuff, and you guys have a big team. And you can say, oh, well, you also have a lot of AUM, right? But relative to AUM, yes, it's a lot of assets, but you also, in my opinion, have an even bigger team, which shows that you guys are investing, like you said, into the company, poising it for, you guys are seeing a way bigger picture. People who think you're big now, I mean, the way that you guys are investing into the business, I see a much bigger picture. So I'd be curious to know if I'm right, and if, like, how you guys are thinking about growing the team and investing into the business for a bigger future.
Yeah, no, thanks, Rob. Appreciate you saying that. Because honestly, so like the last 12 to 18 months, obviously there's been distress in the market, right? Like with interest rates going up, you have a lot of syndicators that have been doing capital calls. There's been foreclosures. And syndicator has become like a dirty word. There's like a negative connotation. And I honestly get pissed off now when people, I don't even want to be called a syndicator. Like I don't want to be associated with it because we feel like we've built a real private equity company. Like we have two offices. Like we bought our office building. We have a 21,000 square foot building in Scottsdale that we own. The three of us bought it ourselves. And we have, you know, 80 to 90 corporate full-time staff that has to be there every single day. We have no remote workers. We have over 240 full-time employees. We have an office in Dallas. And we have, you know, when I hear syndicator, I think of some guy that lives in a different state running a property from his couch.
Yeah, with his mom's basement. Yeah, you know, he went to, you know, someone, you know, miscellaneous boot camp, fly-by-night syndicator, got super motivated, you know, bought a deal, you know, got ripped off because he didn't know what a good deal looks like. Somehow raised money from his, you know, whoever he could raise it from.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, oh, well, maybe it didn't go well, right? As opposed to a legitimate organization and infrastructure and ecosystem which you created.
Yeah, no, and a credit to you guys. You guys have done the same thing. You guys have built infrastructure. You guys are like a real firm. And I think there needs to be a delineation. And again, not to bash him because we started out that way. You have to start out somewhere, right? But it's like when you're getting the results, you know, you want to be recognized that way. So to answer your question, Rob, then I'll pass it to Bikram. Is that, yeah, I mean, this sounds ridiculous. People say like, hey, what's your goal or whatever. Our goal is to be the biggest and greatest real estate company of all time. Like we want to be bigger than Blackstone.
I love that.
And we don't want to hit a goal that we'll just set a goal that we'll hit. And then we feel like you're empty, you're complacent. You know what I mean? Like we want to have a goal so big that we just continue to stay hungry. So we really don't feel like we've achieved anything. And the biggest criticism that we've faced since we started is, oh, you guys have been lucky to be in an up market. You haven't faced a downturn, right? Well, we're facing a downturn right now. And we look at this as a big challenge because we feel confident we'll get through it with no capital calls, you know, preserve investor capital. Because there was a lot of deals at the end of 21, early 2022. In hindsight, we bought at the peak of the market, right? And we bought floating rate debt and interest rates skyrocketed. But we've been cranking renovations to kind of get those deals back on track. And we feel confident we'll do well there. But our goal is to be, you know, really big. And so we like this retail syndication arm just because we have all the control, you make more compensation, but we don't think it's scalable long term, right? So our goal is really to have like an institutional platform where we're raising institutional funds from like endowments, pension funds,
right?
And the idea is you do more volume, you'll make a lot less on acquisition fees, less than GP promo, but you generate recurring revenue like asset management fees, property management fees.
Well, and the interesting thing about that is when you have that structure there, I'm a little bit louder. When you do have, you know, the larger checks like that, you have way less people to report to as well, which is a blessing and a curse. But, you know, reporting to a couple of people as opposed to hundreds of investors, you know, it's tough. Like the $105 million deal that we did, hundreds of investors in that opportunity, which is great, but that's a lot of people to account for.
Yeah.
A lot of phone calls, a lot of, you know, wrangling of cats to get the $50,000 checks, which we love all of them, but it's just a different process.
It's hurting cats. And I'll pass it to you, maybe Bikram, talk about like, what are we doing right now? Like, what is the burdens we have with K-1s, monthly distributions, reporting? And then talk about what are
they
we doing?
They cut out on time.
They did. Yeah. No, yeah. Thankfully, they did. Yeah. And then talk about, like, what are the things we've been doing? Like, you know, like the PwC, all that stuff to set up for future.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the K-1 side, you know, when we first started, it was, again, I was managing the K-1 process. We got K-1s out by, I think, March 15th that year in 2020. But now, after a couple of years of hitting my head against the wall on this stuff. We hired out a tax manager who now oversees the entire K-1 process or the entire tax process for the company as well as our as a property. So, you know, this year we sent out about 10,000 K-1s across our entire company. And we also do back office for the fund managers. So we help them do their K-1s. So all of our investor K-1s went out at the end of February, and we got all our fund manager K-1s out essentially end of March. So that was a big feat. But then, you know, as you kind of mentioned, you have hundreds of investors that you're, you know, reporting to. And to us, every investor is the same, right? We're not going to say, oh, you only invested $50,000 once. So we're not going to take your question as gravely as someone who's invested, you know, $2 million. So we respond thoroughly to every single investor that comes in. And it's difficult sometimes when you send out, you know, very clear instructions on how to like get a K-1 downloaded, but then they send an email back saying like, where do I find my K-1, right?
Mm-hmm. So instead every of day of the last few.
Yeah. We've gotten over 200 emails just for where do I find my K-1, right? So it's we respond obviously in kind, tell them, show them how to do it. We record videos to kind of give them how to download their information. But yeah, no, at the beginning, a lot of the reporting and a lot of this infrastructure wasn't really built out. So when we put it all together, you know, we utilize Update Capital currently as our investor platform. So we send out reporting through there to all the investors. We make sure even on the fund manager side, we send out their reporting on their behalf. We just kind of customize it for their funds. And then, you know, building out the teams to kind of do all that, it took a lot of work to get put in place, but thankfully it's been smoother a little bit, but it came with its challenges for sure.
So I'm curious to know what the tax manager does year round when it's not tax season.
Yeah, so we're buying deals pretty much, you know, every 6 to 8 weeks at least. So every single new deal, because it's a retail syndication, we have to make sure we collect all the tax documentation on the front end, as opposed to waiting until December 31st to get all that information compiled. So Aaron, who's our tax manager, he's basically going in. Once we close the deal, he'll essentially put together the cap table on his end, make sure all the EINs are accurate, all the investments are correct. And throughout the year, I would say like, at least a dozen requests per month on transferring, you know, from their personal name to their trust or from their trust to their, you know, non-revocable trust or unrevocable trust. So, and people, you know, pass away, so you have to worry about that. So taking care of the cap table is a job in and of itself. And then this year or last year, we made the decision to essentially become an audited company. So we hired PwC to kind of do the audits for Rise 48 in general. So he manages a little bit of that on that process, and he helps our corporate controller make sure that you know our entities are all the deliverables that they need that are, you know, taken care of. But he's essentially managing the cap tables and making sure that, hey, when, you know, his showtime comes up and, you know, between November and February, that he's ready to go and we can get these K-1s delivered in no time.
So audits aren't cheap. What is the business strategy behind wanting to be an audited firm?
Yeah, good question, Rob. I think it relates to one of the earlier questions where we don't want to be viewed as a syndicator. We want to be viewed as a real private equity firm, and we're trying to basically position ourselves to take on institutional money in the future, right? And so beginning of 2023, Bikram and the team switched everything to accrual-based accounting because you have to have 3 years of accrual-based to go public. And we don't know if we want to do that or not. I don't know if I want to deal with that headache on the red tape. But in 2026, if we wanted to, we could. I think the criticism is bad now. Imagine if we go public. But yeah, it's like, so yeah, like with interest rates going up and then you hear criticism, we were like, you know what? Let's just become audited. Like, let's hire a big four firm. And what are people going to say? Like, and so basically we are now corporately audited. All the books are corporately audited. And then every deal that we bought from 2023 until now is also audited. And so any investor, we can give that PwC audit report to, and they can see that all the financials are clean. Everything is transparent, disclosed. And so Bikram had our controller, Elise, interview all four of the big four accounting firms. And we thought PwC was the best option for what we need. But yeah, I mean, to give people an idea, like Aaron, our tax manager, he's a CPA. He used to work for a big accounting firm. He's a six-figure salaried full-time employee. You know, these people are not cheap. Our controller is one of our highest paid employees. She's a CPA, you know, six-figure salaried. So these are like legitimate, experienced accounting staff that are kind of overseeing a lot of this stuff.
Right. So we kind of hit on this before. naturally. And one thing that I always hear about you guys is, you know, how quickly you churn through units, which, you know, you're vertically integrated everywhere. You said, you know, Robert is, you know, the GC side. So I'd love to hear about where you guys are vertically integrated, where along the way that happened, and the benefits you've been receiving from, you know, your systems and processes.
Yeah, great question, Craig. So basically, you know, first we brought construction management in-house. So when I say construction management, it means that we are sourcing, bidding out, and managing third-party vendors like roofers, electricians, plumbers. We still use third-party construction companies to do the in-unit labor, like actually the interior renovations, but our staff is walking these units 40 hours a week, supervising them, making sure it stays on schedule, on budget. Okay, so we first brought that in. Then we brought supply chain in-house, okay? So basically, we're using these third-party construction companies, and they're all going to the same place, Home Depot and Lowe's, to get materials. So then we were now exposed to, like, macro supply chain issues, right? Like in 2020, 2021, on the heels of COVID. And it's like prices were going up, and then these guys are like, oh, I can't get stainless steel appliances. Home Depot is out. And we're like, we can't have this, you know what I mean? And so a credit to our, at the time, our asset manager, now she's like, we just promoted her to our president of operations, Kaylee. I told her, I said, Kaylee, you got to find, like, there was another big operator in town that we had heard was getting their stuff from overseas. I said, find out who they're using. And so we got in contact with them. And so we're buying all of our materials directly wholesale from an overseas manufacturer. They have local warehouses in Phoenix and in Dallas. And so we'll give them like a 3 to 4 month forecast, say, hey, we need this many units worth of materials. They manufacture it, ship it overseas to Phoenix. And they have this big warehouse, looks like a Home Depot. And they've got a day staff and a night staff, 24-hour staff, and they're doing custom kits and delivering with box trucks. They'll deliver like 4 to 5 pallets inside of our unit. And our guys go in and open up that pallet and has everything custom for that floor plan. So the exact measurements, the vinyl plank flooring is cut, prefabricated quartz countertops, the cabinet boxes are already assembled, everything, light switches, every little thing you can think of. And so basically it was construction management first, then it was supply chain, so we can control our cost of materials. And once we brought supply chain in-house, because we said we cannot go over budget on these CapEx, right? Because you guys know it's tough. Like if you buy a deal in 2021, pricing is there. And if you're going to take 2 or 3 years to renovate, pricing has gone up later on. So basically what we started doing in 21 is we said, okay, for the supplier, I'll pay you flat price per door, no matter if it's a 1-bedroom, 2-bedroom, or 3-bedroom, okay, for the lifetime of the project, no matter what happens. And they agreed to it, okay, because we're giving them volume. Then on the labor side, most construction companies make their margins on the materials, okay? So they're marking you up on materials. And so we told all the labor, we said, listen, you are now gonna use our materials and we're gonna pay you a flat price for labor. And at first, none of them wanted to do it. And we said, listen, we'll pay you more for labor than what you're normally charging, but I'm gonna pay you a flat number per door, whether it's 1-bedroom, 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom. So you'll make more money on some units, maybe you'll lose a little money on some units, but you'll make money with volume. And some of them are like, oh, we can't hit your budget. And we say, okay, you're fired. We'll use somebody else. And they're like, wait, we'll make it work because we gave them a lot of volume. And so we signed these contracts where that is flat for the lifetime of the project. So there's deals that we bought in 21 where our all-in cost at that time was like around $12,000 to $12,500 a unit to do a high-level scope for labor materials. We're still paying that on those deals that we're renovating, okay? Because we're flat with supplies and with labor. Now, if we buy a new deal, that cost is around $16,500 to $17,500 all in, just because of costs. But we make sure that the deal pencils at those costs today, and we know we're locked in. So first it was construction management, then supply chain, then we brought property management in-house because, you know, on the heels of COVID 2021, we had a lot of our staff that were, they were not our employees, but they were third-party management. They were just getting picked off by other companies, right? And property management, it's a low profit margin business. A lot of these PM companies, that's their business model. They can't afford to pay more money. So our whole thing, let's pay them more to recruit, retain the best people, give them the best benefits. And so, you know, what we did is we had to first decide, okay, what do we want to do? Like, what is our business model? Value add multifamily. Okay, how can we create the entire operations around that and just build a cookie cutter process? And sometimes we see other deals that are really attractive that we want to buy, but we have to stay disciplined. We're like, that's not our business model, right? So I tell people we're very vanilla and it's kind of rinse and repeat.
Yeah, I call it a copy paste strategy, right? Yeah. It's all about a copy paste strategy. And exactly. Exactly. Sometimes, you know, and especially when we go to conferences like this, next thing you know, if you're an LP or something like that, you'll have 20 new investment opportunities and angles, right? And you won't focus on one thing. So the shiny object syndrome is, you know, a very real thing, especially in this business, right? So I really respect how you guys look at that process there and just being very disciplined. Matter of fact, we do one thing and one thing well in a couple markets.
Yeah, no, 100%. So yeah, it's just basically rinse and repeat. Like you copy and paste, like you said, Craig, just keep cranking the volume. And so that we stick to our box, right? We're trying to find like 1980s, early 2000s deals that have value add and that we can do that plan.
Yeah, so I have a question too. Along the way, year-wise and unit count-wise, did you add those different verticals into the business?
We did, yeah. So construction management, supply chain, we added in 2021, early 21. And then it was in Q2 of 21 when we started having issues with third-party PM staff. So I remember it was like July, August, we made the decision, and it's a pain in the butt. We had like 2,000 units and a number of lenders, and it was harder than we thought to start your own management company because you have to get approval from all the lenders. You know how it is, Rob. And it's like, they're like, okay, well, who's your accounting staff? Who's this? Who's this? Who's this? Like, well, we don't have any of that. Like, what do you mean? So we had to float a bunch of money. Like we invested $800,000 up front, and it took 10 months because we had to hire all this staff. And we did not get all the approvals on every deal and go live transitioning till December 1st that year. So on December 1st, we transitioned 2,000 units approximately all at once. And it took 10 months for that company to break even, and then it became profitable. But yeah, so that's kind of, so all in 2021 is when it really started to happen.
Right. To be honest with you, when we moved to in-house management, we went and got lender approval on all of our deals. But I think there was one deal that the lender was just delayed in getting the approval, and we just switched anyway.
Good for you.
And we just made it happen and then figured it out later.
Say, oh, sorry, we already did it.
Sorry, yep. Was that supposed to approve us now?
Yeah, exactly right. Who's going to manage the asset?
It's funny because people don't realize the challenges there. You can't just go buy a deal and manage it yourself, right? The lender's not going to allow that. And it takes time to convince them because they're, frankly, the biggest partner in the deal, right?
Yep.
They're putting up most of
the biggest investor, yeah.
So all the downside as well.
Yeah.
Their upside's fixed. Their downside is, you know, you lose that and they're screwed,
right?
One thing that's really cool is we share a lot of investors and a lot of capital partners, which is, you know, why we want to do this show, just to kind of cross brand and whatnot and, you know, develop our relationship. But our strategies are slightly different. So I'd love to kind of hear your strategies in the marketplace and then also just your perspective on how you structure deals from a debt and equity perspective.
Sure. Yeah. So to give people an idea, like we've done a variety of different debt structures. Like we've done 10-year Freddie Mac fixed, we've done 10-year Freddie Mac floating, and we've done bridge debt, floating rate debt. And we've sold all types of those deals, right? And so we know the pros and the cons from our perspective upon acquisition through operations and disposition. We don't like fixed rate debt because of the massive prepay penalties that we have to pay through yield maintenance. And we just learned from experience. Like we bought a deal in 2019, we paid $17 million for it. We renovated more than half the units and we basically got hit with a nasty prepay penalty. So we do floating rate debt to have little to no prepay penalty, but we mitigate with basically a lower interest rate cap up front. And they'll finance all of our CapEx dollars. And so, you know, for us, we have to kind of see, okay, what is our business plan? What makes the most sense for the returns? And we've structured the debt around that. I mean, I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Bikram, but that's kind of what we've seen just historically.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it from like a cost of capital perspective, right? So if I go out and raise that money from investors, I have to pay, you know, a 16 IRR on that money. And at the same time, like we're not in a market where I can spend $5,000 into a unit and raise rents by $1,000. That's not going to happen. So if I'm spending $16,000 a unit to increase rents by $200, I need to reduce my cost of capital as much as possible. So if I can get bridge debt, which is going to finance my CapEx, which is also going to help make sure that I, you know, keep to my business plan. I even drive, you know, confidence into my investors to let them know like, hey, I know this money is not freely available for me. I need to go submit a CapEx draw to get the money back. But the lender's not just going to write me a check. They're going to go in. They're going to verify that I renovated the units. They're going to do an inspection. They're going to look at the numbers to make sure I'm hitting my pro forma. And that's when they're going to give me the money on my end. Like we have lenders who scrutinize every little, you know, line item in a draw where they'll even throw things out to say, okay, well, we know this was part of contingency, but we don't think this is going to be part of the CapEx, so we're going to take it out. So, you know, we'll fight them along the way here and there. But overall, you know, that money's not sitting in our bank account where investors can feel like, oh, we can just go ahead and start renovating anything we want to. Obviously, we stay disciplined. You know, all the investments are in different silos. None of the capital is commingled in any way. But we want to make sure, you know, that investors are happy, lenders are happy when we execute our business plan. There's actually evidence of that happening, not just, you know, us putting it on an investor report, oh, we renovated 108 units. Like you can go walk the 108 units and see that they actually renovated.
So a couple of things that I admire and that we follow as well is the focus element. And I think that's a large factor of our successes, because if you're trying to go do deals in Tampa and then Phoenix and then Denver, it's going to be really hard to not only get awarded deals, find good deals, and then execute, right? The whole thing is just super tough. So to me, focus is a no-brainer. And you're saying, you know, it's tempting. We look at some deals. So I'd be curious to know. But at the same time, I think there's something to be said about evolution. For us, when we first started, you know, the first deal we bought was Class C crime, big issues, right?
Yep.
And that's kind of where a lot of people cut their teeth. And then as you grow, you tend to see operators move into B class and then into A, right? Yep. So how do you guys balance, you know, that evolution, I'll call it, versus sticking to your knitting?
Yeah, no, I think you said it best, Rob. It's funny. If you look at most syndication groups, people that get into it, it's so hard to break in, right? It's so competitive. And when you haven't operated a deal, you're so focused on the numbers. You're focused on, I want to get a high going in cap rate. I want to get a low price per door. I want the deal to underwrite well. And when you haven't operated, you don't realize that the lowest price per door, the highest cap rate doesn't necessarily mean that you'll actually perform at those levels because your demographics aren't as good. So, you know, we've bought some deals that are not in great locations. In Phoenix, they were a good basis and we did well on them. But we were also fortunate the market was strong because when the market, you know, kind of flips with interest rates and inflation and new supply coming on and organic rent growth in Phoenix goes negative, the areas where we have a lower median income, higher crime, they're a pain in the butt to operate, right? Your delinquency is higher. It's just a lot more intensive. And we bought like a lot of 1960s, 1970s deals, right? When we started as well, because those are just, you don't really know the difference when you're starting, right? You don't realize, you're just like, oh, it's an apartment
building. Real estate's real estate.
Yeah, exactly. You don't understand the operational challenges with mechanical systems, chillers, master meter electric, insurance challenges for getting those older deals. And then you really start to learn about it when you try to sell them. Okay. So when you go to list it, it's like, why is my buyer pool, you know, a third of the size for a 1960s, 1970s deal as compared to 80s? And that's even become more pronounced the last 12 to 18 months, right? Okay. A lot of the institutions will not even look at 80s now, right? Sometimes we only have a couple of lenders that will even finance them. And they won't even touch 60s or 70s. Like, really, it's agency. And so I think the natural evolution that a lot of people go through and that we've gone is like, okay, we want to be 80s vintage or newer because you've got individual air conditioners, individual meter electric. You've just got, you know, better mechanical systems, copper plumbing, copper wiring. And then you want to be in better areas, right? So we really focus on now, what is the crime score? What's the median income? What's the supply? Like, is there new supply around there, right? Because I think when the market was strong, I mean, a lot of people just forgot that supply is a big thing. And now all the new building comes on, all the concessions hit last year. It's a big reminder.
So, yeah. I mean, it's funny. If you go down Scottsdale Road, which I don't know if you have any properties in that area, but if you're in the Scottsdale Road, like North Scottsdale, in that Kierland area, it's just new unit coming up.
Everywhere.
Similarly, we're not trying to buy if we're in Houston in the Galleria or in Dallas in the downtown area, to your point there, just because you want to be beaten up by that. We want to be in more suburban areas that are solid pockets. So. Yeah. With the evolution of the firm, I'd be curious to know what the raising experience has been like, because some deals kind of raise themselves and some deals you're really having to bang the line, call everyone, email call. So be curious to know what that A/B testing looks like on your guys' end now that the market's a little bit different.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, Craig. It's just crazy because we don't have the answer. Like, some deals are really strong and some deals we can't figure out why they're not that strong. Like, we launched a deal at the end of January and it filled up really quickly, right?
I have a theory that the first deal in the year, everyone's excited, gung-ho, ready to go.
I agree.
Does not matter. Everyone's fresh,
right.
Rejuvenated. They kind of took some time off.
New Year's resolution. I'm going to deploy.
New year, new me. Yeah.
Exactly. No, you're right. Every time we launch a new deal in the beginning of the year, it's good. And then we launched a second deal, and it was a little slower. And we're like looking back at the deal we launched last year, and we're like, okay, yeah, that one was kind of slower. And then we launched a deal last week, and it started off really slow. And we had a lot of people who were like, oh, sorry, I gotta get my taxes done. Oh, I'm on spring break. And we're like, crap, it's the timing thing. But it's also like, did we just tap out a lot of people because we're doing, you know, a few deals in a row? So it's tough because that's why we're always trying to find like fund managers we can partner with, diversify the equity. It's tough to raise that money. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. It's difficult. I mean, you could have two deals that have the exact same economics, the same returns. But if one is labeled as distressed, you have more demand because it's like psychology, right? And you can't make it up. Like, we have a deal where their interest rate cap just expired. Their JV equity partner is forcing the sale and they are selling for a loss, right? So they are distressed. And you can get more demand on something like that than another deal where maybe they owned it for 10 years and they're still selling at the same value. So it's just psychology, a lot of it too.
Yeah, to your point there, what is kind of really funny to me is the more, you know, institutional partners we speak with, or, you know, really high level, you know, folk in the space, they really are story driven, which to me can kind of be silly. It's like the stories, we bought this deal very well. Like, what more do you want? Right. But I understand that they want the, you know, the nuts, you know, the story within the story, the why as to this deal as opposed to any other deal. But you know, sometimes it's just, hey, we got this for a great basis. It was a, you know, interesting situation. So have you kind of seen that as well, to your point there?
We have, yeah, because a lot of our, all of our lenders are publicly traded REITs, right? They're debt funds. And so they're all institutions. And a lot of our lenders are also our competitors because they have equity arms too. And so we had a few deals that we launched this year, and we had one lender that did both of them. There's one deal that we thought was the best of the three, and one lender like quoted the other two and not the one that we thought was best. You know what I mean? For whatever reason, because they didn't like the story. And so, yeah, it is pretty interesting. But yeah, we had lenders last year, as an example, to an earlier topic, that were financing our 80s vintage deals. And now this year, they're like, we're not doing 80s anymore, and, you know, and just across the board. And so it's interesting.
So how do you foresee the evolution of the acquisition strategy as you're looking to target more institutional equity? Like you said, you're looking to scale and get into more pension endowments, right? For them, 2000s is the new 80s. So you have to, I think you have to evolve.
Yeah. I mean, right now, you know, our bread and butter is the syndication arm. So we're continuing to kind of pound the pavement essentially for those 80s, 90s, or 2000s value add. Last year, I think we spoke with a number of like private equity firms out there, institutional investors, and a lot of them obviously are on the sidelines. But you know, they did give us metrics that they look at, which is, you know, they want 2000s plus vintage. They want light value add. They don't want us to go in and like, you know, spend 16,000. They want us to spend $1,200 on a deal and increase rent. So we're like, well, those don't exist. So if I go tie up a deal like that, my investor's not going to want it. You may or may not invest. So it puts me in a pickle, essentially. So right now, our biggest focus is, you know, find deals that our investors do like, and value add deals that we can execute on, as opposed to trying to tie up like a 2020 deal and then going out to these pension funds or sovereign funds or whatever to, you know, potentially look at the deal if we can get even to the door on that end. Even if it's a great basis, great deal. Again, as you know, they've never worked with us. You know, there's a dating game that goes on that end, and really kind of breaking into that institutional equity, it could be a double-edged sword. Like, we could get a great deal. We could get somebody to just write, you know, 90% of the check and then end up, you know, having to hire someone just to deal with that relationship. Like, that's not something we want to do either. So we've been focused on 80s value add the entire time, or 80s or 90s. And something that kind of fits our investor model right now. And we know the market's, you know, bottoming out. It's going to get better. And we know that institutional equities is going to come back, but we don't want to be in a situation where, you know, we have to, you know, go through all these hoops just to line up one equity check and then accidentally let go of the syndication arm on the other end.
Yeah. I'd be curious to know too, we're both seemingly really in the weeds on the equity raising side. What are some of the objections you're, you know, handling today as it pertains to raising capital for deals?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think a lot of it is just people are scared of like the timing. And it's kind of funny. I mean, I saw you post something about this, Rob, but you talked about the paradox of when the best time to invest is when nobody wants to do it, right? And it's like everybody on LinkedIn posts that cliche quote from Warren Buffett, right? Oh, when people are greedy, be fearful. When people are fearful, be greedy. But nobody does it.
Yeah. Right. They all I'm selling my house to liquidate so I can invest in Lone Star deals right now, actually. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay, selling good job, high right? there.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So I think, we'll face some objections for having the floating rate debt. And we try to explain we're buying a really low interest rate cap, and we've underwritten the deal so that by the end of year three, if rates have not come down, we feel confident our NOI and DSCR is high enough to be able to qualify for a agency refi. But it's just weird because sometimes it's really strong, sometimes it's not. I think it's also the frequency of deals that we're doing. But I mean, to add on really quick to what Bikram just said, to be honest with you, if I could go buy a brand new build and slap 10-year fixed rate debt on it, I would just do that. It's way easier. There's like no operational risk really. But with our retail investor base, what we've seen just from our experience, we've bought some deals where there's really no value add, and it's harder for us to do that. It's like the optics. Like, they want to know that you're doing something adding value, even if it's a great economics, right? I think you guys have bought deals like that. I don't know. I'd be curious to hear your experience, because we have trouble raising money for those, and we feel like, okay, I got
better deals.
They're the better deals. They have less execution risk.
Right. Everyone wants to see the before and after, you know, disgusting, exactly. You know, wood grain looking kitchen from Ica to, you know, the quartz countertop and white cabinets. Yep. They want to see the new flooring in it.
Right.
But similar to your point, we are acquiring a deal right now in Houston, and the cap rate going in was like a 6.48 on an A property. Like, wow. That doesn't exist. That is an impeccable basis. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that deal, people are like, I just don't know where.
The business plan. There's no value add. And
right.
And I literally start the webinar. This is not a value add deal.
Yeah. You make it clear, right? No, that's a perfect. So that's the retail psychology, right?
It's tough.
And that's why we had to stick to our box, because like Bikram said, first of all, you know, most of the Class A deals are bigger and more expensive, and I'm just terrified to tie one up and lose my earnest money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I don't know if I can raise the money.
Yeah.
But if I had institutional money, we basically, to answer your earlier question, we will structure the debt and the business plan completely around the equity. Whatever the equity's goal is, we'll change the whole structure. So if institutional money, I'll buy newer vintage deals, put 10-year fixed rate debt, not aggressive rent growth, you know, but you have to kind of shift it.
Yeah, I mean, the way we look at it is we're solving for a 14 to an 18 IRR any way we can get it. If that's a value add opportunity, great, we will do a value add. If that is a 20 to 30% discount basis play, like the deal I just discussed, awesome. Shouldn't you want to buy discounted real estate? That doesn't happen very often, especially with the market we saw before. This is just, you know, the correction process we're seeing.
Yeah.
Or we'll find it in a tax payment structure. So those are the three routes that we play in. It's like, if we can give you that there, that's awesome. And Christopher Mendez with Pearlmark said this. He's like, if I can deliver to you a 14 to 17% IRR, that's the type of investor you are. It's like, if I can just give that to you with the basis play.
You're not a value add investor. You're seeking value add returns.
Right.
So if I can deliver that to you in a different strategy that's actually less risky, shouldn't that make you excited?
No, I agree 100%.
Good pitch.
It's psychology. It's just psychology. Like, they want to see that you're doing something and adding value. They don't understand where the margin is coming from, I guess.
Right. So be curious to know, and this is something we're looking to perfect as well, which is kind of the launch process, right? And you probably have feelers with equity partners. Maybe you've got 1031 exchange into your, you know, your deals and whatnot. But how do you kind of go live? Do you have kind of like an early access pool to it?
Yeah.
You know, how long is it, like timetables and whatnot? You get a deal locked up. What does it look like for you guys? Because we're looking to, you know, do that best. And it's obviously, you know, we want to make sure that it makes sense for the equity. But be curious to know how you angle that.
Yeah, no, good question. And so for us, like, so obviously we have our process where we're raising money directly from investors. And then we have like fund managers. We work with broker dealers. We have a few RIAs now that are bringing money through a fund to funds model. But typically we always launch our deals on a Thursday morning for whatever reason. So we have like a marketing team, and we have one lady is our analytics person, and she like tracks all these analytics. I couldn't tell you too much details about it, but apparently for our experience, we've launched deals in the past pretty much every day of the week, except Sunday. We've done Saturdays. We don't think Mondays, Fridays, or the weekend are good because people are kind of checked out. We think from our perspective, Tuesday through Thursday are the best days to launch. So on a Tuesday morning, we'll do what's called like a quote unquote early look. Okay. When we first started, it was like us manually sending an early look email. So it was like an authentic, you know, email, which basically, you know, shows that, hey, I'm just giving an early look, you know, kind of a sneak peek. And it wasn't the pretty marketing blast, but it had like, here, click here for the deck, click here for the webinar, click here to soft commit. And then we're like, okay, we have too many investors. A lot of them want early look. So we basically created a template in our CRM, which looks like we typed it, but we really didn't. It's an email blast. Okay. And it's like, I don't know, 75 to 90% of our investors get that now. So we say, okay, I'm going to send you an early look on Tuesday to give you a head start. And so really it's like we kind of soft launched it, or really launched it Tuesday, but it's not the pretty marketing blast. And they know Thursday we're going to launch it. Right. And so Thursday morning we do the formal blast, which is like the pretty marketing blast with all the information. And, you know, we typically want to see we're hitting a certain amount of our raise, you know, by Wednesday night from that early look. And then what we've seen is like after that Thursday blast, I think a lot of people have actually looked at it, but they were kind of waiting. When they see it, they feel like a sense of urgency. Exactly. And so, I mean, I never wanted to be this guy, but the reality is when you're raising money, you have to create scarcity. Otherwise, people do not move. They need deadlines and they have to act. So we used to give people, I don't know, we've done deals where we give them like 6 or 8 weeks and then they don't move. So we always launch it and then we give them 2 weeks to sign and fund. And then we try to close 2 weeks after. So like we always build out a pipeline. Bitcoin Online will always sit down on the calendar and we'll say, okay. And we want, in this environment, we want at least 4 to 5 weeks in between our launches. So I want like 4 to 5 weeks of quiet time, you know, like cooling off period. just so we feel confident that we can do it. So that's internal. Like we'll do Tuesday early look, Thursday launch, and then we'll do and by Thursday afternoon, we're typically pretty close to our number, because in the beginning, I'm trying to build out allocations, right? So I'm saying, okay, we're gonna raise X of this. I gotta find, this is where I know I think we can raise. I wanna be conservative, but I need to find other people. So like weeks before we launch, I'm reaching out to fund managers, broker dealer, RIA, whoever we partner with. And these guys get tapped too, right? You guys know how it goes. So I have to stagger them. I'm like, okay, yeah. John Smith just did the deal last month. He's out for 3 or 4 months at least. I can't reach out to him, otherwise it'll overwhelm him, right? And they're like, oh, I haven't talked to her in like a quarter. Maybe I'll send this to her. And so I'm sending the deal to like a ton of fund managers a few weeks before, because like they'll get intimidated and overwhelmed if they have to be on our schedule. Like where they launch and only have 2 weeks to fund, none of them will do it. They need at least 5 to 6 weeks. So like we're having to create our investor deck. I record the webinar at least 2 or 3 weeks before we even launch, and I'm sending it out to fund managers. So I'm saying, hey, we got a new deal, new fund manager opportunity. You can launch now. Like we'll let them launch now because they need more runway than us. And so I'm building out allocations in an Excel spreadsheet, Becker and I are, and basically trying to fill that, right? And it's always fluid. It's never a perfect science.
No, and it's always clunky because someone falls short.
It's always stressful. Yeah. It's
a jigsaw puzzle.
Dude,
and there's missing pieces all the time that you got to find from, you know, the other side of the house, so to speak, right?
We have to close a deal next Friday, and I just had a $3 million 1031 dropout last week. So I had $3 million bucks with like a week. I'm like, okay, great. You know, so like I'm like calling some of the high net worth guys I know, and we got to try to fill that, you know? And so it's always stressful. And every time we launch, it's like, you're like, it never gets easy. You know what I mean?
No,
it never. Yeah.
You think that as you grow and build out your investor base and grow your demand, you'd think it gets easier, but
yeah,
it really doesn't, because at the end of the day, you are solving for, okay, you have to raise $15 million for a deal and you have to create allocations, like you said, but you're always going to have people coming in, coming out,
yep,
coming up short. And so I don't know. It seems like it doesn't get easier, even though you feel like it should.
I know. And these people have nothing to lose, all right? They don't have earnest money at risk.
Yeah.
So it's like they can just bail or not hit their number. I mean, Becker, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Becker has strong opinions on it.
Yeah. Bad opinions about it. Yeah, no, it's I like working with fund managers. I think as long as the communication's there, it's helpful to know where everyone's at. I think tracking is where it gets very clunky, right? So when some fund managers don't hit their number, they tend to like stop communicating, or they don't communicate on their end, and we have to kind of guess where they're coming in. So, you know, and Zach, I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, every single deal is its own little problem. There's never a, hey, we're going to, of the $15 million, $10 million already accounted for, the last $5 million. No, it's going to be every dollar in that $15 million needs to be accounted for somewhere. And, you know, some deals will have, you know, only a few fund managers. Some deal will have a lot more fund managers. So when the pendulum goes towards the more fund manager side, it just gets very clunky on when, like, where is the equity raise at any one point. So we try to make sure that we communicate early on and we give them early on deadlines. So they're communicating on, hey, this is the number they're hitting on, so that we can go in and say, okay, well, do we need to add more fund managers? Do we take out some fund managers? Or, hey, if someone's not communicating, okay, assume they've dropped, let's go with somebody else there. So, it's almost like you're kind of working with like a high net worth individual who's kind of choosing whether they want to invest in a deal or not. They commit to $500,000 and then say, you know what, I'm just going to do $200,000 now. So it's like, okay, well, I didn't realize that you were going to do that. So I have to actually try to figure out that you're going to only hit $200,000, and then I have to go backfill it with someone else who says they're going to do $500,000, but they're actually only going to do $300,000. So it becomes a huge math problem, which is not fun to solve.
So, well, I was going to ask about, you mentioned earnest money. You also mentioned, Zach, about being scared to tap a large deal. I'd be curious to know what your guys' philosophy or buy box is right now as far as deal size. For us, we're always looking to push ourselves. We want to scale up and grow into doing larger deals. That's the goal. I don't want to do 20 deals a year. I see a perfect vision of the business as doing 6 deals per year that are on average $75 million. I love that idea. So I'd be curious, what scares you today and what are you trying to grow into?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rob. And so, yeah, I mean, right now we have to raise so much equity for these deals because with the higher interest rates, you get lower leverage, and then we're raising a lot of reserves. And then we also buy these expensive interest rate caps, right? So it's crazy. Like our equity raises are like a 60% ratio to the purchase price is how much we have to raise. And in this environment, we really don't want to be over a $20 million raise. So like I'm telling brokers, but you also want to push yourself too, right? It's like you don't want to take your time and bandwidth to not push your potential, right?
Right.
And so I'm telling brokers right now, send me anything 15 to 40 million purchase price, right? Because that's going to be between like a $10 to $20 million equity raise, roughly, right? And but like we just launched three deals this year, and the first one was 22 million. That one went really well. The next one was 21 million. That's the one where I just had this hole, this $3 million hole, and that one's been tough. And then we launched another one, was like 18 million. And it's just, those are stressful because those are big freaking raises to go back to back to back. And so, you know, we want to do like a smaller deal next just to give ourselves a breather. And, and so, yeah, I mean, so like with like a new Class A deal, for example, most of those are bigger deals, like in the markets we look at, and they're huge raises. And so I wouldn't want to raise more than like 10 to 15 million max on that, but I can't even find a deal that size, I feel like. So that's why if I know what works and I know we can execute that plan and we can get a good return, we've kind of stuck to that, but it's just tough because, and what I'll do, one other quick thing, and I'll end on this note for this topic, is that like we try to overstack the allocations.
I was about to ask that. I was literally about to ask how much you're going to do over. Yeah. Yeah.
You have to, because like Bikram said, a lot of these guys are not going to hit their number. No. So like I would say like maybe 25% of them actually hit their number. Like I'm going to commit to 500K. I'm like, okay, sounds good. I got you for 500K. In the spreadsheet, 200K. That's what I do. Like
story
I,
of our life.
I cut them down. And then what it does is that if somebody over exceeds, great. I'll like kind of give their allocation away to somebody else. And I tell people first come, first serve. So I say, if I got a really strong fund manager, like, hey, I'm at this, can I get 500K more? I said, go for it.
Really enjoyed this conversation with you both. Well, thank you so much for the listeners. These guys are some people we really respect. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Peace.